There are now only 2.5 weeks left before the election, and this will represent a welcome respite from the barrage of television and radio advertisements which, at great cost, have been filling the airways. If there is a fall off in the numbers who vote, and there may well be, this election will go down as the most expensive per vote in history. It's already cost well over $100 million. It takes an act of conscious will to remember the pre-convention debates and the hubbub which preceded the actual presidential nomination. Six ran for the Democratic nomination, and the number was weeded down one by one as the primary voters rendered their verdict. The Democratic candidates retired like gentlemen when they saw that defeat was inevitable, with one exception, Jesse Jackson. Jackson held on to the end. He worked hard to maximize his visibility as a titular head of what he calls the Rainbow Coalition, a coalition of the have-not groups of our society, the homeless, those on public assistance, gays and lesbians, Latins, and of course, the black. As head of the Rainbow Coalition, Jackson demanded his place on the convention program and the agencies that manage the Democratic Party. He received pride of place at the convention, but it did him little good. Dukakis was willing to give Jackson all the floor time he wanted, but he was unwilling to give him the vice presidency or any guarantee on appointments. Jackson promised at the convention to campaign zealously for the Democratic ticket, but for most of the fall, he was hardly visible. He was surfaced recently at several Dukakis meetings. Jesse Jackson had been busy campaigning for Jesse Jackson and complaining that the powers of the Democratic Party do not understand black needs. His speech to the convention in Atlanta was a rousing one, which pleased the more sentimental members of the Democratic Party and the more extreme left. A fine speech by Governor Dukakis shows that he could not easily be upstaged, and he was equal to the task of running for the presidency. Dukakis showed good judgment also in the selecting of Senator Lloyd Benson as his running mate. The senator is an older man with a great deal of congressional and Washington experience. The Republican convention in New Orleans lacked the drama which Jesse Jackson helped maintain in Atlanta. It was a state affair. The vice president had known for weeks that he was assured of the nomination. Televangelist Pat Robertson stayed in the race. But his was a one-issue campaign, and Robertson is back now where he belongs, managing the 700 Club on television. It's interesting to note that the two persistent runners-up were both ministers of the gospel, Jackson and Robertson. I'm afraid that this says something about the growing importance of special interest blocs in presidential campaigns, and the growth of evangelical Christianity as a political force. The tone of the Republican convention fitted well the natural gravity of the vice president. He too gave a well-scripted speech, but it was not the speech for which the Bush convention will be remembered. It will be remembered for Bush's surprising selection of Danforth Quayle, a junior senator from Indiana, as a running mate. The senator is a lightweight. He had trouble finishing college. He had trouble getting into law school. He needed help to enter the Indiana National Guard. Quayle is young and attractive, but as a man, he possesses a lackluster mind and seems to have little comprehension and few of the contexts which one would assume were necessary for a president. I was tempted to entitle this sermon, Three Men and a Boy Run for the Presidency. In 10 years in Washington, Quayle has failed to distinguish himself in any visible manner. Conventional wisdom suggests that the vice president chose him for his youth, his good looks, and his appeal to the right wing of the Republican Party. Quayle is, after all, one of the most consistent defenders of the present archaic methods of letting defense contracts. He has voted against all attempts to affect gun control. He has taken a hard line on crime, criminals, and the criminal justice system. I suspect that if the vice president could do it over, he would not nominate Danforth Quayle. certainly has had to keep him off center stage. The campaign so far has lacked clear issues. The Vice President has accused Governor Dukakis of being a liberal, which he is to his credit, and a card-carrying member of the American Civil Liberties Union, which he is, and has every right to be. He's accused Governor Dukakis of being soft on criminals for sponsoring in Massachusetts a prisoner release program. And he has made political hay of the fact that one of the many released felons murdered again. The Vice President is adamantly opposed to abortion, except in cases of rape, incest, or to protect the life of the mother. He opposes all public spending on abortion. Governor Dukakis insists on the right of a woman to have an abortion. He favors Medicaid financing for abortion for low-income mothers. And he insists that the final decision to abort or not to abort is to be left up to the woman who is carrying the child. The governor is far more advanced in his thinking in this area than is the Vice President. The American Civil Liberties Union has a long and proud history in the United States defending those who are defenseless. The Vice President tried hard to turn membership in the ACLU into a suspect affiliation. My opponent, he said, is a card-carrying member of the ACLU. The words reminded us of the unlamented Senator McCarthy, and unfortunately, some of it struck pay dirt. Governor Dukakis has accused the Vice President of being uncaring about women's rights, indifferent to the plight of the poor and the homeless, and caring more for the privilege of the wealthy than for the needs of the many. He has in mind the Vice President's espousal of a 15% capital gains tax cut and his refusal to consider various necessary welfare programs. The Vice President insists on the death penalty for anyone who murders a policeman carrying out law enforcement duties. He insists that society has paid more attention to criminals than to the victims of crime. The governor is opposed to the death penalty, has taken a more enlightened view of the criminal justice system, as shown in his support of the prisoner release program in the state of Massachusetts. Both men agree that much more needs to be done on the war on drugs. More detectives need to be hired, penalties need to be increased, pushers and their bosses need to be jailed. The flow of drugs must be stopped at their source. Both men claim that there will be more investigators in the field, and that the United States will use its international power to cut off much of the drug trade. A surprising amount of campaign time has been taken up with these kinds of personal issues, which are clearly important to the population at large, but certainly not the central issues of a presidency. You have to listen carefully to hear what the candidates have to say about defense spending, about the Strategic Defense Initiative, about disarmament, and about foreign policy generally, areas in which the power of the presidency is paramount. The Vice President is in favor of an almost complete continuation of President Reagan's defense program. He would cut out programs only when there is reciprocity, a reciprocal cut by the Soviet. Governor Dukakis opposes specific programs such as that of the mobile midget missile and the mobile MX. He favors only limited research on SDI. Both candidates supported the IMF treaty, but the Vice President's position on further arms reduction seems to be go slow. He makes a great deal of the fact that because we are strong, the Russians had to agree this time to the IMF reductions. Governor Dukakis would be willing to take more of a chance on Mr. Gorbachev. We are at a crossroads in foreign political matters. Mr. Gorbachev has pulled his troops halfway out of Afghanistan, signed an MF treaty and begun to destroy the missiles under that treaty. He has widened the Soviet discussions with the United States to include such hitherto forbidden issues as the Gulag, which he has largely dismembered. He has permitted some increase in immigration and foreign travel for his citizens, and has begun a political liberalization campaign within the Communist Party. It's hard to whip up a Cold War sweat when your enemy is saying, quote, "The socialist vision is not working. We need to understand if some of the forms of the West can work for us and help us out." Such issues are clearly the key issues of foreign policy for the next presidency. Both have spoken welcome words about glasnost. Both have been extremely cautious in the words they have chosen in response. Neither has found the words which would effectively echo America's desire for security and peace. The issues that seem to separate the two candidates the most are in the area of foreign policy. The Vice President believes in supporting the Contras and taking a hard line on Ortega. He approved the American action in Grenada and the use of our naval forces in the Persian Gulf. The governor opposed the invasion of Grenada and the oil-faring missions of the Persian Gulf fleet. He opposes all aid to the Nicaraguan rebels. Is much more willing to meet the Russians halfway, trusting that Gorbachev means at least half of what he has to say. The president's last months were predicted to be a period of administrative weakness, but are now seen as evidence of his strength and of vision. The Soviet Union is moving to liberalize its economy and its political structures. Members of the Warsaw Pact nations are restless. There have been protests in Poland and Estonia, and nationalist uprising in Azerbaijan. Russia and China seem to be on their way to their first summit in 40 years. On the economic side, the issue is the budget deficit. The Vice President is an advocate of a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. The governor is opposed. Even if such an amendment were passed, there would be at least a decade of problems before the deficit had been whittled down to the point where one could talk about a balanced budget. The deficit presents a frightening prospect for Americans. The figures are stark. Between 1980 and 1988, the fastest growing element of the federal budget was the annual interest payment on our national debt. It stood at $52 billion in 1980. Today it is $151 billion. In 1980, 21 cents of every dollar paid in federal income tax went to meet the interest on the debt. This year, more than 37 cents of every tax dollar will go to that purpose. When Reagan became president, 79 cents of every income tax dollar was available to pay for our domestic needs and for the military. When a successor takes office on January 22nd, only 63 cents of every dollar will be there after the interest bill has been paid. This means a steadily increasing erosion of our ability to finance current and future needs. Both men avoid any mention of taxes, new taxes. The Vice President says dramatically, "Watch my lips," and then he mouths, "No more taxes." Dukakis favors a tax increase only as a last result. But it must be clear to both men that taxes will have to be raised to meet the budget deficit. All that this particular stand means today is that neither man wants to make the same mistake Walter Mondale made 4 years ago when he spoke openly about a tax increase. Neither man seems to have a plan to significantly reduce the budget deficit. The Vice President espouses something he calls a flexible freeze, hoping economic growth will eliminate the deficit. Unfortunately, we've had this kind of freeze for some time now, and it isn't working. We've had 6 years of economic growth, and the annual interest payments are rising, not falling. The governor says that he would lower interest rates. Unfortunately, federal expenditures keep a constant upward pressure on these rates, and foreign banks and individuals now hold about 1/7 of our treasury notes. Till the day we finally have a much more balanced budget, we'll have to learn that we are no longer cock of the economic walk. On domestic and foreign policy issues, President Reagan's good luck has held. The president's last months were predicted to be a period of weakness. They are now seen as evidence of his strength and of his vision. Congress has passed a major welfare overhaul. The Vice President can claim, and does, that this and other legislation is a result of the President's effective policies. In any case, Mr. Reagan's success, deserved or otherwise, can only help the Vice President. Those who thought that the Reagan administration, beset by the Iran arms scandal and the Meese scandal and others, would go out in disarray, fail to recognize the resilience of this President, who will go out with flags flying. What do I feel about this election? I feel that the debates settled little. Governor Dukakis did well on the first go-round, not so well on the second. A large uncommitted vote hangs over this election, and there is no guarantee that people will come out in any number on November 8th. Either man will be bound by the same restraints. Most important of these is the national debt, now approaching $2.8 trillion. Neither can make good on his initiatives to deal with education, child care, the environment, and national security if he cannot spend for new programs. And he cannot until he can figure out how to pay for or cut older programs. There are other major constraints facing the next president. The persistent deficit in the nation's external payments, that is, to foreign countries. As the cost of servicing the foreign debt rises, the growing dependency on foreign capital and the powers of other countries to retaliate if this country were to adopt a protectionist course also rises. The American president faces restrictions on his power to lead, but he also enjoys some rare opportunities, principally the recognition by the Soviets that they need peace and openness for the sake of economic development. There's a growing recognition on both sides, Russian and the United States, that the interdependence of economic strength and national security. A consensus on economic competitiveness and national security appears to be emerging, and this could provide the next president a tremendous opportunity. If it does, I pray that he will use it very well. Amen.